You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 28 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. If you happen to be one of the 2 billion users now that are on Facebook, you can check out our page there, Social Media and Politics Podcast, or tweet us at SMNP Podcast. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Social Media and Politics Podcast. And yes, you heard that correctly. Mark Zuckerberg announced on June 27th that Facebook has hit over 2 billion monthly active users. And it's important to remember that we don't really know how these metrics are calculated, and they can be a bit suspect. So what Facebook decides to call a monthly active user might not really be a very active user at all. If we look at Facebook's video metrics, for example, video view is counted after 3 seconds. So if you see a couple thousand views for a video, that number might be a bit misleading as to how much it's actually been viewed and taken in. But regardless, it sounds very good for Facebook to say that over one quarter of the entire world is on its platform, which just by sheer mass would attract companies, organizations, and political parties to have a presence on Facebook. So in our last episode, we looked at what type of ads political parties in the UK were targeting, because there was just an election there at the beginning of June. And this week, we're going to stick with that theme of the British elections and targeting, and we're going to look at how the Labour Party, but also civil society groups and regular citizens, are taking to the internet in order to campaign for the left. And at least in the realm of politics, when it comes to digital campaigning on the left, it's hard to beat a bigger name than Blue State Digital. Blue State Digital is perhaps best well known for helping Barack Obama craft his 2008 and 2012 campaigns, which were able to mobilize a large number of people who typically didn't vote. And among that group was the youth demographic, who typically don't show up at the polls. But this year, in the case of the British elections, they clearly did, with turnout being estimated around 68%, which is compared to about 45% from 2015. So a huge surge in youth mobilization. And the question is, what role, if any, did digital play in that upsurge in youth participation? So I came across this article on Blue State Digital's website, and I'll put it in the show notes, but they highlight three aspects that contributed to Labour's success in the 2017 general elections. One is that British progressives have embraced paid social, so that refers not just to political parties, but also to advocacy groups that can use digital to help campaign for a political outcome or political candidate that they favor. Two is the rise of civic tech, which refers to citizens or volunteer groups of citizens building digital tools to help campaign for their party or cause. And the third aspect that the article attributed to Labour's success in the last election was mobilizing the youth vote, which the first barrier is getting younger voters to actually register so that they're eligible to vote. So I wanted to dig in a bit deeper into these topics and what was the role of digital in mobilizing youth, but also being used by advocacy groups in order to campaign for similar causes that the left and Jeremy Corbyn were fighting for in this last election. And so in a second, I'm going to bring on Samir Patel. He's a managing director at Blue State Digital. And one of the outcomes I took from our interview is that the role of citizens are really important, because we've been talking a lot about data targeting and what are campaigns doing. But what really came out in this interview for me was the role that citizens are playing, whether it's in terms of this civic tech and developing tools that help communicate and coordinate from the bottom up, or whether it's coordinated sharing by citizens. They can be a campaign's great asset, not just in terms of sharing content and increasing the organic reach of a post, but also by adding some collective weight and giving the idea of a movement or a resistance. And this coordinated action by citizens is something that's going to lead very nicely into our next episode, which is with Dr. Joel Penny, who is an associate professor at the School of Communication and Media at Montclair State University, and he's just written a book called The Citizen Marketer, which is all about citizens' role in the electoral process and how their participation increasingly follows logics of viral marketing. So a little bit of foreshadowing there. Next week, we're going to dive into that and also look at the role of citizens in the Bernie Sanders campaign that, interestingly, has a lot in common with what we're about to talk about here in the British context. Joining me now to talk more about Blue State Digital, recent British elections, and what's happening on the left side of the political spectrum, let me welcome Samir Patel to the show. Samir oversees the business, team, and culture at Blue State Digital London, as well as advertising on strategy and creative. Samir, thanks so much for taking the time out. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So I was reading this article on your website that I was telling our listeners about in the introduction, and it states that 2017 was the year British progressives embraced paid social. And, you know, much of the Labour Party's success has been attributed to increasing digital advertising. And the sense I got from the article was that it's more than that. It's about advocacy groups and citizens. So can you kind of unpack that? Why was 2017 the year that British progressives embraced paid social?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a wider push for civic engagement and the role that technology can play in that. And one thing we do know is that lots of people here in the UK feel that parties don't represent their interests. This is part of a wider trend of people feeling that they don't trust institutions the way they used to. You know, trust in media is at an all-time low. So what we're seeing is a lot of people trying to put the power of politics into the hands of people. And technology is a great way to do that. So whether it's, I know you had our friend Sam Jeffers on previously, things like Who Targets Me, whether it's sites such as Who Can I Vote For or Swap My Vote, these are all things that are basically taking some of the difficulties with our system here in the UK and making it easier for people to know how they can make a difference themselves online.
Mm-hmm. And it seems, or at least what I've been reading in the media, is that it's been a lot about mobilizing the youth and the youth vote. What's so special about the youth vote?
Well, one of the things that's special about it is it hasn't been there for a while. So, you know, since 1992, the youth vote has been fairly low here in the UK, you know, sort of under 50%, sometimes, you know, upper 30%. And as a result of that, a lot of politics and a lot of politicians have not focused on the youth vote in recent years. What we saw this time around is that there was a candidate and a manifesto and, you know, ideas that really engaged young people. And I think we saw turnout be extremely high, probably the highest in the last sort of 20 years in this election. And I think that that's only going to increase because, you know, I think over 80% of young people were not satisfied with the result of the EU referendum, and 750,000 people became the voting age since the referendum. And all of those people are starting to get very engaged. And I think that there was something that happened in this election, which was for the first time in a while, they felt like they were spoken to.
Yeah, and you kind of anticipated my next question, which is the Brexit referendum was seen as largely the result of not having the youth vote because, you know, 18 to 24 year olds are highly in favor of remaining in, but their turnout rates were quite low. So what explains that push? Was it the manifesto and the candidate, or was it other initiatives aimed at registering people to vote or get out the vote initiatives?
Yeah, I think it was a number of things. I don't think we can point to just one single thing. And it kind of goes back to your first question as well. It wasn't just the parties. Many different organizations were focused on getting young people to register to vote. And I think that, you know, that's a big push because people want young people, you know, involved in politics and making sure that they have a voice and making sure that, you know, they can represent themselves and their future. So there's definitely a push amongst lots of different groups and organizations to get young people to vote. So, yeah, I think the youth vote got mobilized this time around for a few reasons. One is that they felt spoken to. So there was a candidate, there was a manifesto that really resonated with them. But I also think it goes back to the EU referendum and many young people feeling deeply unsatisfied. 80% of young people felt unsatisfied with the EU referendum result. 750,000 young people came of age since the EU referendum who couldn't vote in the EU referendum and actually could vote in this election. And after they saw the result of the Brexit vote, they became more engaged. We have a number of different organizations who are focused on getting out the youth vote and also making sure people are registering to vote. There's also been a number of things over the past few years that have made it harder for people to register to vote. So it used to be that you could register easily through university. That's been taken away. It used to be that one person in your household could register the entire household. That's been taken away. So structurally, it's become harder for people to register to vote. And so I think as a result, many organizations are trying to make sure that people do register and do have a voice.
There was an interesting initiative that you worked on with this group, Hope Not Hate, an advocacy group where you're essentially building a national voter registration base aimed at driving people to gov.uk to register to vote, to kind of overcome some of those structural differences. So can you talk a little bit about that initiative and the role that it played in mobilizing voters in this campaign?
Sure. So, you know, we've worked for over 7 years with Hope Not Hate. They're an anti-racism charity and political organization, and their purpose is really to hold the far right to account. And so they campaign against parties like UKIP. They infiltrate hate groups like the KKK, and they report on what they find. But they also do a lot of work in communities. So they encourage people to come together to embrace diversity. And this year, for the first time, they invested in paid social, and we helped them with that. And we worked with them to both on a national level and also sort of on a targeted level to identify Hope Not Hate supporters that were in sort of UKIP areas and mobilize them to vote. We also tried to identify people based on research that perhaps UKIP were targeting and give them facts about UKIP and make sure that they can make an informed decision. And then also just in general across the country, identifying young people and getting them to register and then also getting them out to vote. And so I think the young people component of that's really interesting because Hope Not Hate did some research with BuzzFeed. And out of that came that we found out that young people who lived in these more kind of marginal competitive seats had a higher likelihood to turn out and vote. So we had to really deliver in those areas some urgent language, informing them of this and nudging them to get out and vote. So across that entire election campaign, you know, we reached millions of people and hopefully drove thousands of actions up and down the country.
Yeah, and I think there's two interesting things about that, this Hope Not Hate campaign against UKIP, which is one, it shows the kind of civil society component sort of coming in and trying to influence a political outcome, which I think is interesting. But the other thing is that I was looking at some of the examples of these ads, and they were very, like, they had like a seedy rap kind of deep house aspect to them in terms of audio, and they had very kind of raw footage like you'd see from a security camera or something. So kind of giving it this like mystery or crime genre. And so I wanted to ask about the role of creative. I mean, is there a special aspect about youth that you have to design creative content for them, or is that taken into account?
I'm gonna give a vague answer and say yes and no. I think that the role of creative is very much around tone and messaging and knowing your audience. But I also think it's about the audience creating messaging themselves. I don't think there's a takeaway, for example, that is you need to be, people need to be spending more on highly produced, very polished creative. I think there's an aspect of that, absolutely, because that's what people expect. People are used to kind of, you know, mobile content and digital content, and, you know, you need that to stand out. But at the same time, I think that a lot of the things that cut through, and even in this last UK election for Labour, for example, are things that are steeped in the vernacular of the internet. And what I mean by that is you have the mainstream media, for example, a few days before the election, the Daily Mail running a 13-page spread against Jeremy Corbyn, calling him a terrorist sympathizer and so forth. But what was really interesting is you had a lot of young people, as soon as that happened, putting out a hashtag called Last Minute Corbyn Smears and basically mocking a lot of what the Daily Mail was saying. And a lot of young people don't read the Daily Mail, but they're well-versed in how the internet works and being able to jump on something online and turn it into something fun and engaging and creative in and of itself. So, and we saw videos taking off with grime artists and so forth. So a lot of those things were not things that were done by, you know, an agency or required lots of different creative input investment. There were things just took off organically amongst the community themselves. So yeah, it's kind of a roundabout way of saying it is a bit of both, because I do think you've got to cut through. You've got to have something that feels very digital and resonates with people. But at the same time, sometimes you can't really recreate what happens organically online.
And just as a plug for our next episode, we're going to be talking all about this, what Dr. Joel Penny calls the citizen marketer. So stay tuned for that. But I want to ask about, so you mentioned that there were these, you know, there was this liar, liar video and this kind of bottom up campaigning from citizens. But what about in terms of targeting? How did that go this time around? Was there a particular strategy, or is the youth targeted more? Or what was the kind of mindset behind that in 2017?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, I think it's well known that the conservatives vastly outspent Labor in terms of any sort of paid messaging online in the 2015 election. And I think in the 2017 election, we saw both parties spending very, very heavily. And a big part of that is targeting, because it's what sort of Facebook allows for you. What's kind of interesting is, you know, this isn't new. Brands are targeting people online all the time. I think it's just that now we're seeing it in more of this regulated electoral environment. And we're also trying, with a lot of the efforts that are happening and a lot of the reporting going on, we're also trying to understand how much of it is transparent, how much of it is playing within the rules, how much of it is dark and we can't see, and we don't know if it's, you know, going against laws and so forth. But certainly targeting played a really big role, especially when we have the type of system that we have both here in the UK as well as in the US, where certain seats and certain marginal seats can really make a big difference. So, yeah, people are being targeted on their demographics, on their behaviors, on their interests, on their likes, on their age, on their region, on their location, by both parties, by brands, by kind of everyone and everything who's advertising on Facebook. And I think that type of targeting is only going to increase.
And, you know, from what we've heard from previous episodes, this is Facebook's kind of niche. It has the best suite of tools for this. But what about other platforms? I mean, Facebook is, you know, clearly the one, but in terms of youth, I mean, they're on Snapchat, they're on Instagram, WhatsApp. How do you, you know, account for all of these different platforms? And is there a kind of way that you approach trying to get out the same message across these different social networks?
Yeah, and I think that Facebook is the big one, and it is the one with the most reach. You know, reach is the word that will always come up, whether we're talking about advertising for brands or for political campaigns and so forth. Facebook still offers that. And Facebook also offers, you know, more sophisticated targeting than a lot of the other platforms. But yeah, as you pointed out, a lot of young people are not necessarily, you know, using Facebook as much as they might have used to. They are using Snapchat. And I think all of that has to be taken into account. But I think that this is still early days, even though a lot of these tactics have been going on for a long time and are getting quite sophisticated. I think, you know, the next platform or the future of Snapchat is still being figured out. And we also have to think about closed networks and messaging networks and things like WhatsApp, where lots of conversation and lots of mobilization happens on these platforms. And so I think the future of whether that becomes, you know, more of an advertising platform or a targetable platform is yet to be seen.
Well, speaking of Snapchat, how did the Snap aspect of this election influence the type of campaign? I mean, this was something that Theresa May popped out of, you know, it was unexpected. And I mean, did that have a sort of demonstrable effect on the kind of strategy for this election?
I think it did. And I also think that's where online can play a role, because you can quickly get a message out. It does require having, you know, your paid advertising budget behind it, but you can quickly reach parts of the country where maybe you don't have your kind of campaign machine in place and maybe you don't have people on the ground. So I do think that that's one of the reasons, certainly not the only reason, that's one of the reasons why paid social played quite a big role there. I also think that you had many other organizations getting involved, because for lots of organizations, this was a chance to really push for wider civic engagement, as we talked about earlier. And I think you saw a lot of tools being created. And sometimes the time pressure makes amazing things happen. So, you know, some of the tools I mentioned earlier, some of the sites I mentioned earlier, Swap My Vote, Who Should I Vote For, and so forth. You know, some of these are created for hundreds of pounds and that's it. And that was partly out of necessity, but we saw hundreds of thousands of people using them. And I think that's what was really interesting. And so the future of this type of, you know, civic engagement coming from many different places, not just the political party, not just the big trusted institutions, is going to be really interesting and is only going to increase.
Yeah. And I want to ask a couple questions. Both about civic tech, but also the transnational aspect of Blue State Digital. But first, I mean, as you mentioned, there's been this rise in civic tech. And it's interesting that because of the online, because of some of the digital aspects of it, that people can create tools for relatively cheap. And there's been some mention that, you know, the left in this recent British election has kind of modeled some of its activity off of the democratic resistance in the U.S. to Donald Trump. So can you talk about these transnational trends in terms of that non-official political campaigning?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, the resistance movement in the U.S. Was very much about people feeling that the system has either let them down or they can't necessarily influence or have the same impact through traditional channels and the traditional way of getting involved with essentially voting. And so this has kind of gone back to a lot of the things that were done for both Howard Dean and Obama and things that, you know, Blue State have worked on a long time ago in the past. It comes down to organizing and mobilizing. And what we saw in this UK election, actually, and also what's happening in the resistance movement after Trump's election, is that that type of convening and organizing is still very important, and if anything, more important than ever. So with all of the talk about paid social and social media and youth vote for Labour in the 2017 election, actually a lot of what was done really well was organizing and motivating and mobilizing people. So Labour has a pretty large base of supporters, but they basically turned them from followers to campaigners. And part of that was technology. They had tools they were using around, you know, SMS and canvassing and using voter data and Facebook data and so forth. But they also had other groups such as Momentum, which is their kind of unaffiliated or affiliated but not official Labour group, which is a campaigning group that really went out and mobilized people across the country and sent them to marginal areas to knock on doors and to get people involved. And it was a combination of online and offline. And I think we're seeing that in the U.S. as well. We're seeing organizations such as Indivisible, which basically started as a, you know, a Google Doc about different congressional areas and ways you can get involved, and is now a pretty formidable, powerful organization with representation all across the U.S., which is all about getting the right type of representation and the right type of actions out of Congress. So I think that's only going to increase over here in the UK after this election. So we're going to have people starting to think about, okay, how do we start to get people engaged and get people to influence politics outside of the traditional channels?
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, it's not that British voters are isolated from American voters. I'm sure there's some communication going on across them. But I want to ask about the kind of regulatory differences between the U.S. and the U.K., because we've heard from previous guests that the U.S. is like the Wild West in terms of regulations about targeting, purchasing data from commercial warehouses. And is the U.K. different?
Well, I mean, it's not just the U.K. I think Europe has stricter laws around data and privacy, and that's only going to increase with the new regulation, GDPR, sort of coming into effect May of next year. So I do think that there is some stricter regulation here. But at the same time, I think that there is a lot happening online here with data and with targeting and with advertising than what people realize. And that's what's coming to light through lots of, you know, journalist efforts and just people powered efforts. So, you know, we still can't see a lot of the what we call dark social, a lot of what's being targeted to people online unless we have volunteers bringing it to light. And so that could be having a very large impact. That can also mean that very big money can influence elections here. There's interesting investigative reports happening around the role that foreign bodies and foreign organizations had in the EU referendum. So I think that some of it we just don't know, some of it we can't see. So while there are probably some stricter laws and regulations here, I also think that there's this open question about transparency on the platforms and what we're able to see and what we're able to not see, because, and we also just have the phenomenon of different outlets creating a lot of noise online. So, you know, Russia Today, for example, puts out lots of information and lots of content online that gets picked up by mainstream organizations, that gets propagated online, and that has nothing to do with data and privacy and so forth, but it has a lot to do with influencing sentiment online. And there is lots of wealth and money behind, you know, organizations like that, just like there is in the U.S. around Breitbart and so forth, that can have a lot of influence regardless of data.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, I know it's kind of looking into the crystal ball a bit, but when, you know, the difference between the U.S. and the U.K. is, you know, the U.K. is being part of a larger regulatory framework of the EU. I mean, we have Brexit coming up potentially, you know, in a couple years. How might Brexit and the UK's withdrawal from the EU affect the future of campaigns?
Well, everything we've heard so far is that the UK will still abide by a lot of these EU data regulations and laws. So as far as we know, that will still continue. But yeah, as you rightly raised, that is an open question. And we don't know exactly what will get negotiated, exactly what Brexit will look like. And so potentially there could be different laws or systems in the UK, even though right now every indication is that they'll follow the same regulation.
Mm. And then I have a question, you kind of alluded to it before, which is both the UK and the US have these first-past-the-post systems, and that kind of seems very suited to targeted campaigning because you could point out the specific constituencies that you want to win. But Blue State Digital has also worked, you know, in the French elections, the Dutch elections. So is there a difference you notice in trying to mobilize voters in a first-past-the-post versus a parliamentary system?
I think there is. I think that ultimately it is about the audience. So regardless of the electoral system, you know, it is about sort of identifying who needs to be engaged, where efforts need to be invested, where there are safe seats or marginal seats. So ultimately, regardless of the system, you have to know who your target audiences are, and you need to focus on priority audiences and so forth. But I think that, you know, what will happen in a system that is outside of the US and the UK, it will become a little bit less around the geography, but it will still be, so the where won't be as important, but the who will still be important. Because, you know, parties will have to think about who's actually going to come out and vote and who's going to make a difference. And there's still a role of targeting to play there, and there's still a role of data and all of that.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of parliamentary systems, I mean, just got out of this the UK general election. But, you know, everyone's eyes are on the German federal elections in September. Are you guys working on that already? Or is there, because I'm curious as to with Germany, it's, they have very strict data privacy laws. Germans are very aware. They're, you know, all about Bitcoin and you know, not posting on Facebook. So are you moving into that election? And is the German case special?
Well, I mean, for all the reasons you mentioned, it is special in terms of, I mean, even just working with brands that want to do any sort of advertising work in Germany or any type of marketing work in Germany, it's very, very different. The social networks even have to abide by some very strict rules there. We will happily kind of talk to all kinds of different parties and groups around the world. Currently, we're not working with the German election, but certainly we'll be following it with a lot of interest.
Right. All right. Well, Samir, this has been super interesting. Thanks so much for taking the time out.
No problem. Thank you very much.
I've just been speaking with Samir Patel. He oversees the business, team, and culture at Blue State Digital's London office. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. If you enjoyed the show and the topics that we talked about, be sure to tune in again next week when we talk to Dr. Joel Penny about the role that citizens play in political campaigns, and in particular, some work he's done on the most recent Bernie Sanders campaign. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at SMMP Podcast. Check out the Facebook page, Social Media and Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Pesetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.